You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you all very much for coming. I'm Leonard Binardo with the Eurasia Program and the Open Society Fellowship and other stuff, and it's a real honor to be here with Svetlana Zaleshchuk from Kiev. Many of you have heard, perhaps incessantly, George Soros talking about Ukraine as the new Ukraine. And we're going to talk a little bit about what that means, this new Ukraine. But if anyone embodies, is an exemplar of the new Ukraine, it's Svetlana. And it's wonderful that she's able to speak with us about the sort of recent goings on in Kiev. Svetlana, as you saw from her bio, has been in the first sector, the second sector, the third sector, the fourth estate. She's done it all. But what's really interesting is how she's transitioned as someone who was a founder of Center UA, who was an anchor person covering the events in the Maidan in 2004, the Orange Revolution for Channel 5, who's done so much, is now a member of parliament. Is now a member of parliament, the Rada in Kiev, as are a number of other very significant journalists and civic activists. And this is something different, frankly. We don't find in most revolutionary situations activists who are able to, with full confidence and integrity, join the power structure. And that transition is a profound one. It's a profound one for a variety of reasons that we will discuss. And I thought that Svetlana and I would just have a sort of maybe 20 minutes or so where we would discuss events of the day and some of these larger issues at hand, and then we would open it up to, I'm sure, the surfeit of questions from all of you. So welcome, Svetlana.
Thank you so much for this kind introduction.
Absolutely. So, Svetlana, maybe we start just with this question of the new Ukraine. George Soros has written abundantly, passionately, obsessively about this thing, the new Ukraine. Do you buy into what you think he's calling the new Ukraine? Is there a new Ukraine? What's it all about?
Well, first of all, I'm happy that I'm not standing in between a few and lunch, so I don't feel this pressure. Well, I think that in order to explain this concept of what is new Ukraine, the best way is to probably describe it through my personal example. One year ago, I was running an NGO that was persecuted, and in December, the president, the last government, previous government, opened a criminal case against us. 1 year ago, we was the organization that was making a documentary film about the biggest symbol of corruption in Ukraine, which is a presidential residence called Mezhegirye. It's a palace, huge palace, one of the biggest, I don't know, that was stolen by the president from the Ukrainian state. 1 year ago, we lived in a country where the leaders of oppositions were imprisoned. Now they're my colleagues in the parliament. 1 year ago, I was one of the activists that was advocating for a number of the reforms, legislations that were mostly devoted to our European integration, to our new strategic course. Now I'm a person that is sitting in the parliament and actually have an opportunity to vote on them finally. After 10 years of lobbying, advocating, campaign for example, broadcasting system, public broadcasting system, and which we believe as journalists, I'm a former journalist, that it had become a spine for our independent journalism in Ukraine. So I think this is part of it, a part of new Ukraine. And I have to tell you, it's even more that now, just recently, we had parliamentary elections, basically 4 months ago, and 56% of those people who made it to the parliament is for the first time in politics. Also, we have 11% of women in the parliament. It's only 2% more than in the previous parliament, but nevertheless, it's a small increase, and we are also happy about it. I also have to say that 30% of those people who used to be the candidates for the parliamentary elections, they were under 35. And this is an impressive generational shift that you feel even, that you feel everywhere, basically. Now we are with a delegation of Ukrainian members of the parliament in UN on the 59th session that is devoted to women issues. And most of our delegation speak English, and this is also one of the shifts that we were expecting as a new generation in Ukraine, to have our leaders be internationally engaged, to be internationally representative. I will start with that.
That's fantastic. That's all good. So 11% women. Yeah. I think for sure that's more than the U.S. Senate. And maybe even the House of Representatives.
Maybe.
I would agree.
It's probably. Svetlana, thank you for that. Basically, then, your answer to my opening salvo about what is this new Ukraine, you just described it, right? 56% new members in the Rada. That the other 44% are really terrible, but the 50, as we know, but that 56% new members, fantastic. What is it like then for you? I remember Svetlana was at a dinner we had in Kiev a couple of months ago, in which there were all representatives, the sort of Maidanshiki from all different sectors, many of whom are now in parliament. What is it? One question that Mustafa Nayem raised at the dinner was this question of how one affords to be in parliament, right? The salary of a Rada deputy is not significant, and the salary of a journalist, or a, as you were, both an investigative journalist and an anchor person, clearly, or even as the executive director of Center UA, was clearly significantly higher. And since corruption remains such a profound, malevolent force in Ukraine, how does that all work? How do these incredible activists like you, passionate, who led this, some call it a revolution, some call it other, whatever, sort of reform movement, how do you make that happen?
I have to say that, you know, in Ukraine, we are talking not about progress even, but we are talking about survival on these days. We're in war with Russia, with one of the most powerful countries in the world, in the East. And at the same time, we are also have another front, and this front is with our old system. Because I have to tell you that it's not up to the new president, a new government, a new parliament to change the country. It's about how civil society, how citizens can change the country. And it's the most difficult part, you know? Just by putting the electing a new president and by having a new parliament who is voting on new legislation, it doesn't mean that the culture has changed and the mentality and the, all these rotten institutions started working from the very same day differently. That's not true. And it will take probably decades to overcome this Soviet gravity that we had, to overcome this old culture and to teach people with new skills, new knowledges, new approaches. Because when, you know, when I come to our communal services office and I say, excuse me, my water doesn't work. And they don't say, oh, really? Oh, okay, let me help you. Okay, so what? It's, you know, it's the Maidan didn't change that particular approach. And this is what our life is about. It's about these small pieces that is creating the whole picture. But at the same time, the burden on our shoulders is very heavy. And the responsibility actually is, and this is how we understand it, that either this is our window of opportunity to build our new country and to succeed and to realize our European idea. Because I have to remind you, this is the only nation in the whole European Union who died for European values. I mean, we were standing with European flags and with European slogans, with European stickers on ourselves, ready to sacrifice with our lives because we believe in it even probably more than some European countries do. So talking about the salary, it's an interesting fact. I'm getting, I'll tell you, it's $180 per month now. Why? Because the depreciation inflation cycle is horrible. Our currency devaluated, let me think, four times.
265%.
Yeah, exactly, in recent months. So I was getting, I don't know, 10, 20 times more being in my previous capacity. So taking this choice, it was a very clear understanding that it's my, I don't know, financially it's a big sacrifice for me. And I don't know, I wouldn't be able to find probably in the United States or somewhere else in Europe, young people having several languages, graduated, having a fellowship in Stanford, who would say, okay, now I'm ready to get 20 times less just because I want. So, but I just want to underline with that, that yes, for many of us, it's just a clear understanding that it's our country, that we were waiting for this window opportunity for years and years, that we have experienced censorship and we chose freedom of speech, that we have experienced political persecution and we chose political freedom of expression, that we have experienced, I don't know, when we were put into the prisons, many activists were, and we chosen political competition. So this is how it works. It works on this huge enthusiasm of people in politics, of new people in politics, but also in society. Just giving you one small fact, that our army in the beginning of this military conflict was completely, I don't know, non-existent, I would say. It was devastated, it was robbed, it was not there. But with volunteers all around the country who decided that they want to be soldiers and who voluntarily went into the army, with many, many citizens who donated maybe for the first time in their life a lot of money to support the army, now we at least can say that we are and have an army that can fight with Russian Federation. And really, I know that the culture here in US, it's completely different, and it's difficult to believe that probably in Ukraine for 20 years of independence, it was the first time when people donated so much money for different kind of causes, for wounded, for those who families who lost their members of the families, to support army, and for other issues.
And how is it in your estimation, Svetlana, that people can, at the same time, like you, go about their daily activities, in this case, working as a parliamentarian, working on reform legislation, trying to create a sort of non-corrupt, more accountable, more transparent government, and at the same time, there's war. From an outsider's perspective, it seems improbable how you're able to kind of juggle those realities and still be able to succeed.
Well, you're right. We are, as I've said, we are fighting on two fronts. One is in the East, another one is internal fight. But these two battles, they are interdependent. I mean, yes, with having this humanitarian crisis and military conflict in the East, it's much more difficult to implement the reforms because it gets all the resources, all time, all attention, all people's minds and so on. But at the same time, the only way, this is what we believe, to win this war is to make our European idea succeed. Because in fact, Putin doesn't want to control just eastern part of Ukraine, Lugansk and Donetsk region. It's about making European idea fail in the country. And so we believe in the longer term perspective, reunification, reuniting of people, territories, Crimea, eastern part, it will be based on the people's will to live better life. And it's up to us to ensure that there is this better life. And it's up to us to make it with our legislation, with our accountable government, and with all this reform process that we are talking about. But at the same time, the role of international community is absolutely crucial. And I'm not just talking about finance, because I believe that money doesn't have to be the ransom for a real leadership. And as we know, since the World War II, it's for the first time when the international security system, where the core basis of the international system were violated by Russian Federation. And I'm talking about this sacred cow, as we call it. I mean, this red line, and it's a territorial integrity. But at the same time, we see that neither United Nations, nor Council of Europe, nor OSCE can actually help it, nor NATO, by the way, right? So we feel that we are in front of this big, big challenge, and sometimes we're alone there.
But have they failed to live up to their mandate? NATO obviously doesn't have a mandate in Ukraine, but these other organizations you mentioned, OSCE or Council of Europe, UN, are they failing to do what's necessary for Ukraine? Certainly George Soros thinks that. Do you also?
Their opportunities and their missions are very restricted. And, you know, having the aggressor in the seat of the Security Council, who has veto on all of the decisions, I'm talking about Russia in Security Council of United Nations, cannot help the situation.
Right. But just in terms of, say, the European Union or the U.S. government, they have the capacity, political challenges to one side, to allocate an extraordinary amount of money to support a country whose economy, as I think you very fairly said, is imploding. They also have the capacity to, political challenges to one side, provide weapons to allow Ukraine to more effectively, some might argue, defend itself. Has the European Union, in your estimation, not lived up to what it should be doing?
I remember that Roosevelt, who had this foreign policy mantra, he said that you have to speak softly and carry a big stick. And I think that this is what West does to Ukraine, but just reversed, you know. And
small stick.
Yeah, loud and voice. Speak loudly. Express a lot of disturbance and other things like this. But yes, you're right. I mean, economically, we face huge challenges in economy as well. As you know, we have the biggest economic crisis since already decades. And I just prepared these numbers that recently IMF, International Monetary Fund, assessed Ukraine's total budget deficit at 10% of GDP. And the public debt is skyrocketing, and from 41% of GDP at the end of 2013, and now we have approximately closer to 70% of GDP debt. And the bank system is collapsing. A lot of banks are being closed. Me personally, I have two accounts in different banks, and they bankrupted.
Not Privat.
No, not Privat.
No, why don't you have your money in Privat?
Well, it's I was not that progressively thinking. however, there was, as you know, there was a positive news from IMF, and 2 weeks ago, I believe, IMF made this statement that they are ready, together with other countries, with US, European Union, to give Ukraine approximately $40 billion of support in the framework of so-called extended facility. I forgot this. Concrete number. Extended fund facility, yes, a program for 4 years. And this money considered by government to be enough to start the reforms and to be able to survive in this hostile economic situation. Talking about the weapon, absolutely right. As you know, this discussion is very, very important for Ukraine at the moment. As I said, our army was a weak place in our government, in our state system, and but today in the morning I read the news that Obama met Merkel, and he publicly made a statement that he will not go in to give a lethal weapon to Ukraine after this conversation with Angela Merkel, because they want to give a more space for peaceful negotiations and political dialogue. At the same time, as you know, Ukrainian political leadership, together with parliament, me personally, I was voting an appeal to U.S. Congress, Senate, and also White House, so that they consider to give Ukrainian state weapon. And first of all, we were talking about defensive weapon, not offensive, but defensive weapon, which is also very important. I'll tell you that after Minsk agreement, it was the agreement that was done a couple of weeks ago together with Russia in Norman, so-called Normandy format, with Angela Merkel and François Hollande and Putin, and everyone signed after this Minsk agreement, which is has to ensure further peaceful making process. But after signing this agreement, we lost Debaltseve, and it's a very important territory which has this railway possibilities for separatists, for pro-Russians forces to bring in more weapon on these occupied territories. Why did we lose it after already signing the peaceful agreement? Because we just didn't have enough of the weapon to defend this territory. We had our soldiers there, they were controlling the territory, but in 3 days after the peaceful agreement, that was a key point, key area for separatists, and they managed with, by the way, it was a statement done by American ambassador just probably the next day after this peaceful agreement was signed, that after this signing, Russian Federation brought more heavy weaponry. The most modern weaponry in the world was delivered into the territory in order to help separatists to fight for the territory. So defensive weapon is crucial, and we still keep on asking the West to help us. Because in the end, I believe that whether we will be able to succeed only with the help of international community. And moreover, I would say, I'm not sure that this is, we are the last country who suffered from this Soviet gravity, which is embodied in this Russian ambition of building Eurasian Economic Union. And without, we are on the front line, of course. But once again, there is Estonia, there is Latvia, there is Poland, there is Lithuania, who are still keeping worried about their future as well.
So maybe Svetlana, just we can speak more pragmatically for a second to talk about some successes that you, as a parliamentarian, have seen. Participated in over the course of the last number of months, to get some sense that despite all this abiding and sadly enduring tragedy in the East with Crimea, what happened with the Baltics, etc., that in fact life has not only gone on, but the reforms that so many active and engaged citizens and parliamentarians are working towards have come to fruition. Maybe if you just want to share some good news with us.
Yeah, thank you. It's important to deliver also good news. First and most important, after Yanukovych, after we kicked off this former president out of our country, we managed to conduct finally free and fair elections. And we elected our new president, Petro Poroshenko, and also a couple of months ago we conducted parliamentary elections that was also acknowledged by the international community that it's our free and fair elections. It's very important reckon for Ukraine. I know that maybe it's different and it's strange to hear for many of you who are sitting here, but for the 20 years in Ukraine, it was probably not those of many who were really fair and free. Secondly, in last several months, we also managed to adopt number of the packages of the revolutionary and very important legislation. First of all, I will be talking about anti-corruption package of laws. The parliament started to vote on it in summer, and just recently we finished this anti-corruption policy reform. That is one of the best, actually, in terms of how it's written on paper, at least. It's one of the best in Europe. Now, of course, it's not the end, but it's just the beginning. The paradigm shift that before, as an activist, for example, we were thinking about the legislation in terms of its advocation, because we could advocate for the laws for years and years, for example, as for freedom of information bill. We were advocating it for 5 years, let's say. But now we are at the point where it's not enough just to advocate and to vote on it, but the most important phase will start to implement it. But together with that, I have to also say that we established anti-corruption bureau in Ukraine, which will be elected, once again, it's for the first time in the modern history of Ukraine, will be elected by an independent commission that was formed out of, let's say, the biggest authorities in our country. I mean, civil society activists and some professors and some investigative journalists that are well-known and non-corrupt, of course, and independent. So it's for the first time when this head of so high-ranking, so important institution as Anti-Corruption Bureau will be elected not based on the loyalty to the president or to the prime minister or to someone else. And it gives us hope.
But there's still no director yet.
They promised that he's going to be appointed next week.
Next week, okay.
Yes. So it's a process. They elected four candidates already. It's the last phase of this competition, mm-hmm. because it's very open. Once again, I'll tell you, it probably sounds as something small and not small, but for us, it's like a new reality, because we have never experienced this kind of policy making and this kind of appointing of the key positions in the country in such an open and transparent way, than when anyone can see, can control, can check the information. This is what gives us this independent leadership that would be able to find finally this corruption. So for me, this anti-corruption package is the key, because it's the strongest glue that kept this old system together in our country. It was corruption. Now also, we managed to adopt a couple of very important laws in the media sphere. As I've said, it was Freedom of Information Bill, and also public broadcasting system, and some other legislation, some other laws. Whether they work or not, I will tell you a small example which would give you an understanding of how it works like. So for 5 years, as an activist still and journalist, we were fighting so that our members of the parliament disclose their declaration on assets. Like, I don't know whether you have that income statement, basically,
oh, yeah,
right? And it was completely closed information for the public. You could never, we were suing MPs because in accordance with legislation, that had to sort of do it. But finally, when we were running during these parliamentary elections, it was our demand and huge campaign. And finally, we achieved the point where all MPs disclose their declaration on assets. You can easily open our site of our parliament and can see it. Victory. But we have the head of our apparatus of Verkhovna Rada of the parliament, who is the key bureaucrat, the head of all this system. And once again, for years and years, he was refusing to do that, together with ignoring journalists' information requests. And so he did, just a couple of weeks ago, by violating all the legislation, by not afraid, and it's actually a little bit different type of ambience, a political culture now. So what I did when journalists told me that, I wrote my MP appeal. I don't know how to translate it correctly, but it has sort of a status when he can't refuse me to open this information. But he also ignored it. So then I called his staff and I said that if tomorrow morning I won't have this information, we're going to consider this situation on our anti-corruption committee, and we will start the motion for the resignation of this person. Next morning, the papers were on my table, and finally we disclosed it in media, and it was a huge news all over the Ukrainian media that finally, we won this small battle. But what I'm trying to tell, even laws that we are adopting in the voting hall sometimes are not being implemented in a neighboring room, you know? And it's ridiculous on the one hand. And you have to invest a lot of effort and energy in getting this, even this piece of information that logically you would expect that all of them would be ready and willing to give you, because they, once again, they are living in a different country. They are living in a country where people sacrifice their lives for having this, different life. So this is a little bit about how it's working.
Svetlana, right on. That's phenomenal. Can I just, before we maybe move to questions from our colleagues and comments, just ask you one difficult question.
Please. So those were easy, right?
No. I meant difficult as in sort of maybe impossible to answer. You know, once upon a time, you know, in Central America, in like the Central American countries,
yeah.
There were people, whether it was in El Salvador or Honduras, Nicaragua, people would say that these countries, the only way for there to be any actual change for the better required a revolution. Like, revolutions were overdetermined. So what happened with FMLN, FSLN, these were overdetermined revolutionary movements in order to sweep away the vestiges of the past. That could never be done by reform. And people who are revolutionaries by disposition or orientation or mindset or whatever are those that often believe that change, theories of change, have to come by virtue of full-on transformation. The reform will never work because it will always be stolen back by the structures, corrupt or otherwise, that pre-exist that change, right? In some democratic societies, of course, you know, reform is the order of the day. You don't need a revolution because there is enough maneuverability to be able to change policies or statutes or regulations or laws through a process. So my question then is, in Ukraine, at the end of the day, do you actually need to so sweep away the vestiges of that old order so that those oligarchs, whose names we will not, except for Kolomoisky, Pinchuk, Akhmetov, and Firtash, do we need to actually find some capacity to to just cut off their heads? And to cut off their sort of that evil carapace that they control, that will continue to distort and malign the system, and all the profound work that you and your colleagues are doing will always be interrupted? Or can we just do it by reform?
Well, you know, I really believe that this is in hands of our President and Prime Minister and leaders of our parties of the coalition in the parliament. And if they don't understand it or underestimate it, it's their heads that will be cut off, even if not, I mean, politically. Because it's the only way to ensure these reforms is to basically divide, take out money from oligarchic money from politics. This is the only way to start this, to ensure this new Ukraine that George Soros is talking about. But talking about revolutions, I think we overdone with the revolutions in Ukraine already, because we had it in 1991 when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and our students from many universities, we had so-called revolution on the granite, on the stones. When people were sitting just on the pavements and were protesting, were striving for independence of our country. We had this revolution in 2004 when we supported free and fair elections, but we were fighting for our free choice. And finally, it was the last one revolution. Last year, so-called Euromaidan. And I have to tell you that the biggest difference from previous revolutions probably, that this time people were standing not for the new faces. And in fact, there was very difficult relationship between the stage where opposition of leaders were standing and people in the streets. And it's not necessarily that they went into the street because of the leaders of opposition, but they were rather delegating their voices, so that, okay, we hire you for these positions, but you have to deliver. So I'm trying to say that people were standing not for the new faces, but for the new rules. Even if, I don't know, the worst people will be there, whoever is there, they have to play not with the rules, but by the rules. And that's the key characteristics. But you're right. Now we have to make these rules working. And I'm sure that you can ensure those rules only through good legislation, transparent and accountable process of reforming, and then implementation. We will have a lot of mistakes. But as I think it's Václav Gavel used to say, that it's better 5 years of mistakes than 50 years of sabotage, you know? So we will make a lot of failures, but then we have to speak to people, yes, this is, we didn't know how to do that, and there are a lot of flaws in that process. But we are ready to try again and change it and probably fix it and go further. So reforms and political will.
Svetlana, very inspiring. Very, very inspiring. So if it's okay with you, we have till around 1:45, so we have time for questions and comments from our friends and family. And also we have people on the phone.
Great.
So I think Laura Silber, my colleague who directs public affairs here.
Hi. First of all, I'd just like to say that I got the latest stats on women in Congress, and it's 19% in the House and 20 in the Senate. Of women.
20?
I know, it's crazy. Who would have thought?
What did that happen?
Okay.
There's just not that many people. So it sounds like
it's the Gillibrand effect.
That's right. I've got a couple of questions for you. Thanks, this has been fascinating. Svetlana, you're in fighting for rights and for, although maybe not for progress because of the situation in the East. At the same time, do you feel that you come under pressure from people within Kiev who say, wait a second, we can't worry about these problems of reform right now. At stake is our survival. So does that seem almost like a luxury to people? And do you worry about over time, if the situation remains as critical, how you'll be able to sustain the momentum? That's one question. And the second question is, on a different note, people who are critics of giving military support, even if they're defensive weaponry, to Ukraine say, you know what, it's just going to make the Russians angrier. If we do that, even if we're friends of Ukraine, we're actually going to end up, Ukraine's going to be in a worse place because they can't fight against, they can't even protect themselves if Russia were seriously to try and launch an attack, say that they can't, that there's nothing that Ukraine can do militarily, and that defensive weaponry won't function as a deterrent.
Thank you so much. It's a very good question. Well, first of all, about people's perception and people's attitude, we experienced it with the previous revolution, when while you're going through this very dramatic and situation where during Euromaidan we had 104 people were killed, and many of them were wounded, of course. And after that, people's expectations are so high that it's impossible to satisfy it with any political will and any progress that you have. Because there's nothing to satisfy or justify this loss of life, you know. And people are thinking in a different terms, in a different in different way now, because they expect from you everything, and at the same time everything is not enough. So for example, when I said that for me it was a sacrifice to go into the parliament because I don't get my salary normal, so my family has to support me financially, But I don't even say it to people, because for them it would be still, it's not an argument, you know, because yeah, everyone is suffering financially. We are facing a different type of challenge. So yes, there are a lot of critics, that a lot of misunderstanding. I think that the rates of all of the politicians going down, and they will be, especially because of the situation in the East, and because of many families have to send their sons and husbands and brothers, and they are afraid of their lives. And at the same time, as I've said, you expect changes, but changes don't come fast. And even having this very well done anti-corruption policy, the next day when you go to, I don't know, let's say some business institution, some authority that have to register you or to give you a license, it's those people somewhere in the regions on the spot, they will probably ask you for a bribe because they don't care what is going on there on the national level. And these changes didn't reach up to that level. So people would say, okay, so what's the difference? We are paying more, there is a devaluation of hryvnia and of our currency, and we lost 4 times of our everything, of our assets. There is a war. We are sending our children to the war. So what is different? Just new faces on the screen? It's not an argument for us. So I'm just trying to say in what kind of ambience we are living. But at the same time, the only way to cope with it is to talk to people and explain. And it's very difficult, but it's very painful sometimes. They criticize you for everything, even what you can't influence and you can't change and you can't impact. But you have to understand that this is your work now. With regards to second question, I have to say that personally, myself, I was often thinking about it, and in terms of whether this Western support in different ways will escalate, and that we have to do that. But at the same time, talking about so-called hybrid war in Ukraine, we underestimate hybrid part, overestimate, and underestimate war part. Because the level of the humanitarian disaster in Ukraine is enormous. And even being in Kyiv, you can't understand what kind of challenges you face. And I will give you a couple of examples and a couple of comparisons. We lost Crimea, which was illegally annexed by Russian Federation. And it is half of territory of Estonia, let's say, the whole country. And we have 250,000 Crimean Tatars living in Crimea that live in constant fear and under all kind of repression, religious, economic, political, social. To be a Crimean Tatar, it is a danger already itself. They lost their motherland again. Now, talking about Donbas area, we have 1 million IDPs, internally displaced persons, and 1 million people. It's one-third of Lithuania, for example, right? And one day, all these people lost their houses, their jobs, their properties, their assets, just everything. And they had to move somewhere, and they had to build their life from the scratch. We have 2 million people in the East that live on these occupied territories by pro-Russian separatists. 2 million people.
Size of Latvia. Yeah,
well, Latvia is a little bit bigger, I think.
2-4.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And these people live under the threat in this situation where many areas are being shelled. Highly populated civilian areas have been just shelled, and so it's life threatening. And people in these areas, 2 million people, have challenges, go through the trials of not having gas, electricity, food, very often access to just water, food, and so on and so forth. Why I'm telling that? We are in war. We are on front line of that war, and we need help. We need this defensive weaponry to protect ourselves. Because once again, it's about millions of people's life that is there at stake. And we are just saying it publicly that, yes, our army is weak. We don't have enough of resources to help ourselves. So that's why I think talking about escalation and our ability to face these challenges, I think that even radars that can be given to Ukraine that we used during the night to basically identify those shelling weaponry that they are using in the area so that protect people, that would be already a huge, huge help.
Thank you. Svetlana, let's see, we'll take a few.
Shorter?
No. That's a perfect amount of time. We have Justin, Tanya Margolina. Yes, please. And yes, great. Fantastic. And yes, please, thanks. So just, you'll remember who you are.
So you've talked about the military situation and how Ukraine is at a disadvantage, but it's perhaps even at a bigger disadvantage in the information war. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on how Ukraine can respond, if at all, to the Russian propaganda blitz that is still ongoing, and how the government can better frame its message. What can be done? What can the government do? And what help does it need from abroad?
So maybe we'll take a few questions.
Let's do that.
Although those are three questions. But just
take a typical journalistic trick.
Okay. Tatiana?
I wanted to ask, thank you very much for your presentation and your answers so far. I wanted to ask, I don't know if it's possible to step outside of your sort of representative position of the government, et cetera, but it would be very helpful to hear your actual prognosis, most realistic, like what you really think is going to happen in the East, probably counting for if you get lethal aid or if you don't, but just realistically, what do you think is the best outcome there? And I also just wanted to ask, I'm surprised, I didn't hear you mention, I was a few minutes late, but you didn't mention the justice system, at least since I've been here. And I'm, you know, that's something we spend a lot of resources and time discussing here, rule of law, et cetera. So just what is happening with the justice reform, which is, you know, much needed in Ukraine, and if it is possible to reform it without, let's say, firing all the judges, like what do you think is the best way to proceed there? Those are my two questions.
Thank you.
Excellent. Maybe if Sanjay and then Madeline, just we'll see if how.
Yeah, mine flows actually a lot from time. So my name is Sanjay Patel. I'm with the Public Health Program. And my question links to Tanya's question about the justice system, mine specifically with reference to the police. And I just wanted to build upon something that was exchanged earlier in terms of, you know, the credibility of the revolution and how people interface with the state. The police are actually oftentimes the face of the state that people most directly deal with, whether it's the traffic stops or whatever. And the level of corruption is significant, or at least was, with the police. And I'm just curious, what are the specific plans for police reform in Ukraine? I know Saakashvili, you know, when he was in Georgia, fired all of the police post-Rose Revolution, at least the traffic police. Is that in the cards now that he's now one of the consultants, as I understand, to the Ukrainian government? So just thoughts on that.
Thank you.
Okay, maybe then we'll come back to Madeline and Katya. Okay.
So I'll try to be shorter this time. Talking about information war, you're absolutely right. In this hybrid war, information war is one of the main weaponry that is used by Russia. But talking about our possible advantages, let me just give you an example. That Russia Today, which is a Russian main TV propaganda channel, they have access to almost 1 billion of people all around the world who is watching this TV channel. It's the third biggest TV channel in Great Britain. And it's, you know, their level, just the level of their access is enormous. And comparatively to Ukraine, I was talking to yesterday with a girl who is a producer of our Ukraine Today, which is, we started this channel just a couple of months ago. So they have access to, like, online to 30,000 of people every day. It's just incomparable, you know. But we are trying. We are in a position where we have to do everything together. And we established this channel. We are working on another channel that will be able to give more, to deliver more English-speaking contact information abroad, especially. The one of the problems we face as well, that in the eastern part of Ukraine and in Crimea that was annexed, There's no Ukrainian channels and Ukrainian radio or Ukrainian media at all, because pro-Russian separatists, it's the first thing they did, they cut off the channels, and any kind of information cannot be delivered by Ukrainian government to these people. So they don't have any kind of information, even when it is so essential.
Except online.
Except online, of course, internet, but often internet is not...
spotted.
Yes, that's right. Even in the situation where it's so important as about evacuation, for example, right? So many people don't have this information, that there was centralized evacuation from the territories, because they can't get this information. But yes, you're right, it's one of our tasks, and I think there was a good initiative done by, started by European Union. They want to do this intra-pan-European information platform with Russians content that will be available for members of European Union, for 500 people live in European Union but speak Russian, which is a good initiative. Now, about East, what's going to happen? Really, it's so difficult to answer that question. And I think that even if you ask President Poroshenko or President Putin, they won't be able to answer that question. Why? Because I believe that the war will last until Putin wants to last it. And he will go as far as we will allow him to go. Because I'll repeat myself, and this is not about Lugansk and Donetsk. This is not about Crimea. The Putin's aim is, and he was very genuine in it, he said, I want to build Eurasian Economic Union. And this union has to be with Ukraine, because without Ukraine, it's just impossible. So we're not going to give it like this. And his battle is not with Ukraine. His battle is with the West, with the Western system of values. And he's also genuine with it. Probably we didn't listen to him carefully. I'll give you one short story. In 1994, he was at the security conference in Munich. You know, this is a very famous security conference. And the head of that conference told me that in 1994, there was a man sitting in the room, and he stood up and said, you know, I'm thinking that the whole security system have to be reconsidered, and because the Crimea cannot belong to Ukraine, in 1994. And no one knew that man. He was from St. Petersburg. Later on, the head of the conference found out that it was actually Vladimir Putin. That those days he was no one, you know. So it was long prepared, long-term strategy. I don't believe in this Minsk agreement. It's very fragile. It's under threat of collapsing every day. The ceasefire had to start 3 days after the signing it, but now, after the signing, we have 68 people killed. 68. One of them is journalist. Three of them are children. So there is a slow progress. They started today to withdraw some weaponry, and even President of Ukraine recognized some partially withdrawal of the weaponry from the lines. But at the same time, from different sources, we get the information that there was reinforcement in other places of the Russian weaponry. So we don't know to what extent this is a genuine process. With justice, I'm sorry, I forgot that. It was my third point with regards to reform. And I'm very happy to say that it's a big piece of legislation that we voted 3 weeks ago, finally. And it was a really very inclusive discussion. I have to say that it was rather even painful debate between different political forces, different parties, and it was not very easy and smooth. But in the end, we voted for that, and we believe, I mean, everyone now, the political... the coalition of five parties in the parliament are happy with what we voted on. Now, you're right, it's time to implement those things. And first of all, to change those judges who are still there, who were imprisoning the activists during Euromaidan. Now they will have to go through all those examinations and all those procedures that are now embedded into the new legislation. Talking about police, Yes, you are also very well acknowledged, very well informed. We have number of people that we hired from Georgia who already managed to realize some of the reforms with regards to police in Georgia. And in particular, I'll name Eka Zguladze. Thank you. Eka Zguladze. She's responsible for a police reform, first on Kiev level and then on the national level. She's very well perceived by all the political forces, and her reform, her approach is also well regarded, and I think we will succeed with that in particular. It will be one of the, this is my expectations once again, but I think it will be first tangible result that people will feel that it's happening. At least this is my feeling as for now. Also, the big reform of the police was of interior, basically, reform was introduced by the Minister of Interior, Avakov. But the main problem in it is that he, well, which is logical, he says, in order to kill corruption, you need to give people big salaries so that people don't need to bribe anyone because they have to feel secure that they can bring some money back home and feed their children because it's impossible. So far, it's miserable. But at the same time, you don't have this money where to take them from, because as you know, economically Ukraine is in a huge crisis. So it's a vicious circle, you know. It's catch 22. When you need money to kill corruption, but you don't have them. So it's this vicious circle. But anyway, there are some expectations, and there are at the moment. We believe that the reform that is being proposed by the Minister of Interior will have some results, probably not during the first year, but second year, third year, when we'll have more resources to invest in this system.
Phenomenal. Madeline, and then I think Katya, we have maybe like Dana, great, like sort of 10, 15 minutes. So please.
I'll speak very fast.
No, take your time.
My name is Madeleine. I work with the Justice Initiative, and some of my colleagues in Budapest are working or have been working both in Georgia and in Ukraine on some aspects of police reform and access to lawyers and reforms of procedures. So thank you very much for your presentation. Allow me to ask a contrarian question, which I think you may have answered in part, so maybe my question is not only contrarian, but inappropriate. There was a big push very early on after the Euromaidan to integrate Ukraine into the European Union and possibly also into NATO. And some have wondered whether this push helped escalate the paranoia of Putin and threatened his European-Asia economic package. Had these not been pushed, perhaps in part by the West, but rather taken more time, might this escalation have been avoided, and or to what extent this escalation as a result threatened the values and the sacrifices at Maidan?
Thank you for this question, Madeleine. Well, I think that, first of all, history doesn't know conditional mood, you know, and it's very difficult to judge what would happen.
Nice.
But I also believe that from what I've said already with regards to Putin, for example, it was a long-term strategy on building this Eurasian economic union, which is impossible to build without Ukraine. So either it was push from Europeans, although I don't think it was a push from Europeans. I think, first of all, it was the clear choice of Ukrainians. It was about our identity. For many years, Ukraine has been called a swinging country that can't choose basically between the West and the East. And that's what stole us in a gray zone. That's why we were promising, but at the same time, this country where Soviet gravity worked very well, very strongly. But once we made our decision, we made our choice that it's European integration, that it is European idea that is
driving you.
Yes, that is driving us. That is a future for us. It was, I think, irreversible or impossible to have a different trajectory, because Putin has his own plan and his own scenario of how these geopolitics have to develop. So I don't think that it would be possible to avoid this escalation. It could happen sooner or later. I'll tell you also that in 2006, I was reading a report of one of Estonian experts that came to Crimea to study of how it is exposed for Russian potential annexation. And her report was very well done, and it was very it gave a clear message that sooner or later there will be an annexation, because all the structures, starting with media, political institutions, economic approaches in terms of buying the assets, in terms of investing into the economy of Crimea, in terms of building the social networks, in terms of supporting the NGOs and civil society on the spot, gives the clear understanding that Putin is building his future territory there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So we'll take, if it's okay, yes, Svetlana, two more questions before we close. So we have Katya and then Dana.
Sure. I wanted to go back to the 54% first time MPs and 46 were terrible. I actually was wondering if you could talk about what it's like to be part of the new guard and what are some of the biggest fights that you have fought and how it works, sort of how you feel about it. And then the other question I had was about, maybe anticipating the answer actually, some of the anti-corruption measures. There are some that are happening in the parliament. There's a probe into the mining sector. I guess right now the or whatever, very hard to follow from here, I think. But some anti-corruption stuff obviously is happening beyond just the president's administration, and I was wondering if you could say a few words about that.
I didn't understand about the anti-corruption measures in.
I think isn't there a probe right now into mines that had been privatized and then sold off and something like that, and I was trying to follow it, but I'm just curious. Earlier you said it was really up to the president's administration, but are there other kind of initiatives that are happening in the parliament as well or elsewhere?
Okay, thank you. Sure. My question pertains to something you said earlier about a bigger challenge for Ukraine is separating the politics from the oligarchic money. And I was hoping you could speak to how you see that currently shaping, especially given that Petro Poroshenko is, in fact, like a very large oligarchic figure. And do you think he has done a good job ascribing to that idea of separating his money and assets from the politics? And do you think that's something that will or can be replicated throughout government going forward?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to comment about your comment that 46 is horrible. They
no,
are
no,
not. I, they are not, actually. In fact, many of them from old times still, there are a lot of decent people that were in a position during Yanukovych's time. So it's important. Now, talking about how does it feel like, it's exciting and also very challenging, because now you feel that it's actually everything on your shoulders, and you either succeed or you fail. And if you succeed, you will succeed together with your country, and if you fail, it's going to be the same. So there is a huge responsibility on the new generation now, not just vote for the legislation in the parliament, but to think in a longer term perspective and to think of how to ensure the continuity of this political leadership from Euromaidan, of how to build sustainable political institutions, of how maybe to build new parties that would be ready and able to take the lead and to continue. Because despite the fact that there are so many nice people in the parliament, nevertheless, all of us ran through the list of the old parties. So me, for example, I'm an independent candidate, but I was running through Poroshenko list. So it was him who took me and in his list, and I was campaigning basically for his party. So, and it's a huge challenge for this new generation to build this sustainability of this political leadership from Euromaidan. I think this is the key challenge that we have to build. And I really think that there will be a lot of disappointment and mistakes and flaws in the process, and it will take time. But at the same time, it will give at least potential that this car, this vehicle is moving, and this is the most important thing. Now, talking about some anti-corruption measures, right, that, well, as I've said, we are happy that we have this new anti-corruption reform on the central level, and a lot of new institutions, some new institutions like Anti-Corruption Bureau and also preventing corruption preventing agency. It's another new institution that's going to work in Ukraine. At the same time, you are right. On the middle level, on the regional level, on this in this on the spot, you have a lot of corruption that that is happening, and we have a lot of investigative journalists that are disclosing this information and writing, making these materials. Because of it's one of the results of one, the new general prosecutor was changed because people were not satisfied with his progress, with his results of his work, because after many people died and because of the war, people expect, as I said, there is over expectations to the new political leadership. So whether they are dealing with it, I mean, new prosecutors, there are some good results of the investigations, but it's not, from what I would say, there's no a process that I would say that would be satisfying and that you can be proud of and that you can show as a tangible result even on the international level. Now, separating money from the politics, whether it's going well, it's not. And I think that it's the biggest problem of our politics still and of current political leadership in particular. Because we all know, and I'm saying not only here but in Ukraine as well, that all of the parties that made it to the parliament, they were supported by big money. And until we separate it, it will be impossible to change the whole scheme. What we can do is to change, first of all, electoral system and to make an so-called open list together with budget financing of the parties. This reform has been realized in Lithuania, in our Western neighbors of in or Eastern countries in the European Union, and it, from what we know, we made some studies. It gave it was pretty successful. It gave some results, of course, not right away, but it was it was some foundation that gave the possibility to divide this money from politics. As for the moment, I see that without money, you can't get the power. But when and you need this money to withhold your power. And no one from big political leaders are ready to refuse from this drug, I would say.
So with that sobering note, Svetlana, thank you so much for your inspiring and eloquent words and for coming here to the Open Society Foundations. And we just wish you only the best of luck and looking forward to seeing you in Kiev next. So, duzhi dyakuyu.
Я вам дуже дякую. Thank you so much.